Our next case this morning is number 054604, Anthony Heinrichs against Brian Bozma. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. The District Court's decision in this case marks the first time in American history that a court has prohibited state legislators or their invited clergy guests from praying in their own religious language. In my time today, I'd like to touch briefly on standing and to make three points about the Supreme Court's decision in Marsh v. Chambers, which held that those who drafted the Establishment Clause did not regard legislative prayers as a form of sectarian favoritism.
Can I ask if your position means that if the Indiana legislature decided to pass a resolution saying, in our legislature, only Christian prayers will be offered at the beginning of each session, that's perfectly okay? I understand your view to be that legislative prayer is untouchable. And if legislative prayer is untouchable, then I would like to know if that resolution would be acceptable.
Your Honor, our position is not that it's completely untouchable. Our position is that the state does not have a basis for making distinctions between sectarian and non-sectarian prayers.
Well, but what about my hypothetical?
In your hypothetical, the legislature would be requiring that a particular type, that someone within a particular tradition must give the prayer. That would have, assuming you mean your resolution to have the force of law, that would constitute...
Well, it's whatever legislative prayer is, you know. I take it there's some issue about that. Well, but no one could challenge it, and there would be nothing that you could do about it. Is that correct?
That would depend on the circumstances, Your Honor. On the issue of standing, it's our position that taxpayer standing certainly doesn't extend to a situation here where the appropriations are the most general sorts of legislative appropriations.
And it would be the same in my hypothetical, I assume.
That's true. Now, at the same time, there might be other parties who are discriminated against in the context of that resolution who could not pray. Those people under an Allen versus Wright type analysis would be subject to discrimination and could bring a lawsuit. Obviously, that hypothetical is quite removed from here. The practice here is inclusive, and people from all traditions are allowed to pray.
Well, sure. No, I understand that. But again, you're arguing it at a level of principle, and so I think we need to think of it that way. And the historical arguments that you're making would also support the resolution that I'm talking about, only Christian prayer.
Well, the historical
because
arguments...
Because the documents the government has kindly furnished us with show that it was, in fact, Christian prayer that was going on. So if that's history, then we could do that.
There's a difference, though, between a state requirement that the prayer be offered within a certain tradition and then the existence of a tradition that results in prayers of a certain nature. Now, obviously, at the time of the founding, the first eight chaplains were Episcopal priests who prayed within a particular brand of Christianity. Now, it's not our position... it's our position that history supports that and that the reasoning of Marsh says that the framers' intent govern. Their actions reveal their intent in the words of the Supreme Court.
But, you know, your position, and I should let you get back to your standing argument if you want to, but I want you at some point to explain to me why you so quickly brush over the way that Marsh uses the language of saying you can't proselytize, you can't coerce, and also the County of Allegheny gloss on Marsh that the Supreme Court has given us, because I'm a little troubled at the idea as a lower court we should just disregard Allegheny.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I'll take that point now. Even taking Allegheny on its terms, the principle that Justice Blackmun's dictum sets out is that the government may not adopt a practice that, quote, has the effect of affiliating the government with one faith or belief. There are several ways of satisfying that principle. In Marsh, where the chaplain himself had been appointed for 16 years, represented one particular tradition, he decided to satisfy that principle by offering prayers that within the Judeo-Christian tradition. In this case, the state of Indiana has chosen to respect that principle by allowing everyone to pray. The aggregate message is non-sectarian. Some Jews have prayed, some Muslims have prayed, some unaffiliated people have prayed. There have been people in Eastern traditions reflected in the prayers. And that's the sort of diversity, and that's the way that Indiana has chosen to respect this nation's religious diversity.
If only Protestant ministers were proposed by the members, would it be appropriate for the speaker at some point to intervene and to suggest that to the membership, or indeed to insist as the presiding officer, that individuals from other faiths also be approached about giving the invocation?
I think that would depend on the reason that the result was that there were only Protestant ministers giving the prayer. Here, the plaintiffs have not challenged the process for selecting those who pray. It is completely neutral. It's open to all. It's essentially a first-come, first-served policy. No minister who is asked to pray has ever been turned down. And, in fact, members support people who have sponsored people to pray who are not from their own tradition.
If someone were praying, giving the invocation, and it went on for quite a while, or if it did in fact insult members of another faith, or if it did in fact become a catechism lesson as opposed to an invocation, would it be appropriate for the speaker to intervene and to declare the invocation out of order?
Your Honor, there's nothing that prevents the Speaker of the House from enforcing the rules of decorum that govern the way the House is operated. And Marsh obviously respects the legislative prayer tradition. It doesn't respect a longer tradition.
What I get to is whether the Speaker has an obligation as an officer of government to enforce the Establishment and Free Exercise Clauses of the Federal Constitution and to keep things within bounds.
Obviously, Your Honor, he is bound by the Establishment Clause and has an obligation to enforce it, as does every state actor.
I guess the next question I have is, does this record show that the Speaker, in fact, assumed that responsibility adequately?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Marsh establishes that legislative prayer is permissible. Nothing in the Marsh decisions draws any sort of sectarian, non-sectarian distinction. The only reference to that is in the footnote where the chaplain describes his own prayers.
But let me suggest, I really think what Judge Ripple is getting at is critically important, because it gets to the fundamental question, are we dealing here with government speech? Are we dealing here with private speech? Your brief, and we can worry about whether you should be doing this or not, but your brief is trying to portray this as private speech. But many of the prayers were not presented as private speech. Some of the prayers were presented more or less as, you know, I so-and-so, you know, am praying in my tradition, and, you know, they give the prayer and that's that. But many, many others purported to speak for the whole House, used terms we, used terms, you know, the people of Indiana, we should all do this or that. And I think that there's a distinction. You know, when one is speaking for oneself, we have a long tradition of respecting each person's viewpoint, each person's faith, all of the rest of it. And I wonder, I'm going to run a hypothetical by you, if what the district court should have done in its injunction, in your view, on the premise, which I'm not sure is correct, that this is private speech, whether the district court should have insisted that every person giving the invocation begin with something like this language, I share this prayer with you in accordance with the traditions and doctrines of my own religion. Nothing I am about to say implies any disrespect for other religions and viewpoints. To the contrary, I invite all of you to reflect on the terms most appropriate for you. That's not what was going on, but that, it seems to me, would be something that absolutely assured that no one in the room could mistake a prayer as proselytizing, as urging them to change their faith. You know, you could be Islamic, you could be Jewish, you could be Hindu, you could be whatever you are, and there's, you know, you respect the fact that your fellow citizen may wish to pray in the name of Jesus Christ.
Your Honor,
that's not what these prayers were doing, but maybe that's what the injunction should have said.
Your Honor, it's our position that there's no government control of content, and therefore that the speech is private speech.
But if the person is proselytizing in the Indiana House, in the speaker's box, he's not standing in his own front yard making a prayer. The state is involved. Surely, after Lee against Wiseman, how can you dispute that?
Well, Your Honor, Lee versus Wiseman focused on the government degree of the control of the speech. Here, there's no government control of speech.
The government wasn't controlling what the cleric had to say in Lee versus Wiseman. It was a prayer.
In fact, Your Honor, the Principal Lee in that case instructed the Rabbi Guterman in how to pray. Here, the speaker exercises no control over content. But even if this court concludes
that... So as far as you're concerned, the speaker could say to a Presbyterian minister, when you ascend the speaker's box, you can urge everyone in the room to convert to Presbyterianism.
Your Honor, it'd be a different question whether the speaker could urge that. Marsh makes clear
that... But you just said that was okay.
I said it was okay for the person who's speaking in a private capacity to speak in their own voice. And Marsh makes clear that the types of prayers that the framers have heard throughout our nation's history are not to be viewed as proselytizing.
Johnson, if I may, follow on that point just for a moment. The district judge made the comment that everyone was in agreement this was, in fact, government speech. Was that a correct portrayal of your client's position? Was this in fact government speech or is it private speech?
Your Honor, our position, and it's outlined in the reply brief, is that it's an amalgam where all provisions of the First Amendment apply. I see that my white light has gone, and I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Of course.
Sure.
We'll hear now from Mr. Sturgill.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Lowell Sturgill from the Department of Justice, representing the United States as amicus curiae, supporting the Speaker. With respect to taxpayer standing, this case is materially identical to the hypothetical the Court in the Chow case, the Court's most recent taxpayer standing case, put forth, and that's the President giving a State of the Union address. And the Court said that even though taxpayer funds would be spent, of course, on security for the President and transportation and various other things, that a taxpayer would not have standing, taxpayer standing, to challenge the content of the prayer. For example, if the
but
President
Mr. Sturgill, we already explained in our first opinion why we were, at least at the moment, unpersuaded by that. And even though the amounts are small, I don't see where the 54 cents to send the letter to the minister is anything but a marginal expenditure on getting the minister to come. It's not the State of the Union speech where the president is up there saying whatever he wants to say, and he happens to say something positive about religion, which was the only thing. It's a specific expenditure of government time and resources to bring a religious figure in, and instead of having that religious figure give the kind of invocation that's discussed in Allegheny, that Justice Scalia discusses in some of his opinions and dissents, it's sectarian.
Well, let me take the first part of your question first, and that is to say, I think that hypothetical is a very important part, actually, of that opinion. Now, we, of course, lost the Chow case, but as I understand it, the court was trying to lay down a marker and say, we are not opening up taxpayer standing to any kind of a claim. And here's an important example.
Right,
but
I'm just saying I'm distinguishing on its facts. I'm not saying that, I don't think any paragraph of any particular opinion should be tossed out the window, of course. And I know that the Solicitor General has filed for a petition for cert in the what's now renamed case. Since we have a new Secretary of Labor. But here there are expenditures and that are marginal expenditures attributable to this practice, which was, I think, the point of the Chow hypothetical, that there were no expenditures attributable to the president mentioning one word or another in a speech.
Well, I think that's the key distinction, that here the plaintiffs are not complaining about the fact that confirmation and thank you letters are going out.
Well,
and that's not necessary. It has nothing to do with the content of the prayers.
Well, no, you're parsing it a little more finely. They're complaining about the way in which this program is being administered.
But not about the content, not about the thank you letters or the confirmation letters. That has nothing to do with this. The whole key here is trying to find...
All right,
trying
if that's your argument, I will...
Mr. Sturgill, let me take it. Mr. Sturgill, let me take you another direction here. Back in 1789, if this injunction were in force, would the prayer being given by the chaplains in the Congress be prohibited?
Seems to me they would be, and I think that's the basic reason why, on the merits, the Speaker is correct. As we've shown in our brief, from the earliest days of the founding of the Republic, the clerics and visiting, paid chaplains, used Jesus' name in their prayers. Now, the Supreme Court in Marsh said that the practice of opening legislative prayer is not proselytizing, and as long as what's going on is what happened in the history, that basically the chaplain is calling down blessings, general blessings on the legislature.
How about the situation, though, where after an invocation, the Speaker allowed the minister to lead everyone in a prayer, and indeed it turned out to be something that certainly looked more like a prayer service or a worship service than an invocation.
Let me say, I think, in response to that, there's a narrow issue before this court. The injunction bans sectarian prayer and takes the position that courts and the speaker should make a distinction between sectarian and non-sectarian prayer. And I think that's what you should focus on, and that's what you should decide.
And,
that
you know, on that point, I think that's very important, but on that point, as I read the Supreme Court's decisions, the court itself has used that as a line. And I fully respect, you know, the intellectual arguments that there is blurriness at the edges, but as I read this particular injunction that's before us, the only things it tells the speaker he has to do is advise all persons offering prayers to do two things, that they need to offer non-sectarian and non-proselytizing prayers, number one, and that the prayers shouldn't use denominational appeals. Christ's name, Ganesh was in the newspaper this morning, you know, Muhammad, and so on. So I think you're right that we need to stay very focused on what's in front of us, but I don't think some quite as much is in front of us as some of the parties are suggesting.
Two quick responses. First, at page 79A of the appendix, the district court says clearly he's going to take appropriate measures to address this problem if
and
the mere warning doesn't work.
Right. And the district court case is not ripe, right?
The district court itself had to draw a distinction between sectarian and non-sectarian prayers to even enter this order. And it erected a denominational preference, which
was
is
that based on the evidence in the record?
The district court said that Allah is permissible and that Jesus is not permissible.
I said, is that based on testimony that was made available to the district judge, or is that his own knowledge of various religions?
As far as I know, he just made it up. And the second point is, you mentioned the case law. Lee versus Weissman, if I could just read this, at page 588, referred to a requirement that a prayer be non-sectarian as an unconstitutional attempt to direct and control the content of prayers. So if you look at what the Supreme Court has said, it said you can't do this. Ingalls says the government should not be in the business of prescribing the content of prayers. So our position is simple. History controls, and when somebody stands up before a legislative body, they should be allowed to pray in the language of their own faith, and I'm far over my time.
But, we appreciate your help.
Thank you very much.
We'll hear now from Mr. Falk.
May it please the Court. The Supreme Court in Allegheny, speaking of Marsh, noted that not even the unique history of legislative prayer in our country justifies contemporary legislative prayer that affiliates government with a particular faith or belief. Marsh establishes distinction between sectarian and non-sectarian, between prayers that proselytize, advance, or disparage, and that prayers that do not. And the Indiana House of Representatives frequently begins its sessions with prayer that is demonstrably sectarian.
Mr. Falk, can I ask you for some help understanding this injunction? Because I'll tell you, I'm concerned about what strikes me as maybe some tension between the first and the second part of it. I'm looking at the actual language of the injunction, which is on page 1A of the appendix. The first part of it just flatly states that the speaker is permanently enjoined from permitting sectarian prayers to be offered as part of the official proceedings of the House. Okay, if I were the speaker, I would take that very seriously, and I would think, well, I need to do whatever I need to do.
That's correct.
To make sure that sectarian prayers aren't offered. Maybe I need to pre-screen the language, maybe I need to, all kinds of things. Then the second part is far more targeted, simply tells the speaker that he has to advise people giving prayers two things. Now, if the only thing the injunction said was that second part, I'm not sure, maybe we'd still be here, but the case would look very different to me, because the second part strikes me as something quite feasible for the speaker to do, to give a stronger version of advice than what he's doing right now, which is just this, you know, we hope you'll be ecumenical kind of letter, and advice to people that denominational appeals, and certainly it doesn't mean only Christ's name, nobody's picking on Christ, I hope. But you see what I'm saying? I mean, the first part, I think, is what has opened the door to most of the very broad arguments we are seeing, not only from the appellants, but also from many of the amici who support them. You know, and maybe they're right. The courts can't be in the business of sitting around reading every prayer and deciding how sectarian it is.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. I do not read the injunction in that way. The first sentence says, we recognize, in effect, that there's a practice of sectarian prayer. That's going to stop. However, the court implicitly says, we understand under Marsh there can be prayer as long as it's non-sectarian. And then the second part, if the speaker chooses to continue to allow prayers, this is what he is to advise people, to ensure that there are non-sectarian prayers.
But there was a post-judgment entry that started to define things, right? Judge Hamilton took, on page 16 of his entry, post-judgment motions, he defined sectarian Christian tradition by reference to Jesus of Nazareth, Son of God, resurrection, return on judgment day. Was that part of the record that was before him, or is he just recounting his own experience?
Well, Your Honor, I think he's relying on case law, which has discussed what is sectarian and non-sectarian when Christological prayers are being met. But the point about the court's response to the Rule 59 motion is the court says, look, I'm not saying the speaker has to pre-screen prayers. I don't want the speaker to pre-screen prayers. All I want the speaker to do is to say to those who are praying, you have to be non-sectarian, and that means no specific denominational appeal.
But can I just get back? I mean, if the second sentence of paragraph one had said the way the speaker is supposed to comply with this injunction is to render this advice, and then in the opinion clarifying, the judge says, well, if that doesn't work, people can come back to me, at least you would have a concrete injunction now based on the good faith of both the speaker and those to whom the speaker communicates this advice. If there are problems down the road, we don't know what they look like today. Surely those are not ripe for us to worry about right now. If the judge enters some other injunction, we'll have to look at some other injunction in the future. But I guess I'm worried about this link not being as clear as it should be.
And, Your Honor, I apologize, but I have always read this, and I think the trial court itself has made clear in its Rule 59 entry, reads this as there being a link, that the first is just a pronouncement as you have to be non-sectarian. That's the rule of Marsh. That's the rule of Allegheny. And this is how you're going to do it if you decide to continue to have prayers. You're going to make this information available, and that's all you're going to do. And that's quite clear from the Rule 59 entry that all the speaker is required to do is to inform those seeking to pray that here are the guidelines. And the court repeatedly says, I believe we anticipate that people will understand this. It's the difference between non-sectarian and sectarian prayer is an easily understood concept. It's mentioned clearly in the Ball case by the Supreme Court. It's mentioned in Allegheny. It's mentioned by this court in a number of cases. It's mentioned by many courts. And the court expects that to be followed.
Does that establish a non-sectarian religion?
No, Your Honor. Your Honor, this is
well, if you can't do this and you can't do that and you can't do this, you're prohibited from doing that, mentioning deities and or other religious figures. Doesn't it establish a sort of religion which has no particular name for anybody?
No, Your Honor. It recognizes the fact that we have a history of allowing legislative prayer, but it recognizes...
And we have a history of allowing legislative prayer, which included Jesus Christ's name.
That's correct, Your Honor. But again, the Supreme Court itself said not even that unique history is going to justify current legislative prayer, contemporary prayer, which shows an allegiance to a particular sect or belief.
Aren't you really urging the development of a civil religion then? Yes, the Fourth Circuit acknowledged this very... Judge Wilkinson acknowledged that that's where we were headed, very pointedly.
Your Honor, Marsh recognizes that conventional Establishment Clause analysis, which would draw bright lines between any religion and non-religion, simply doesn't apply when it comes to legislative prayer. What Marsh says, however, is what we're going to recognize is a form of prayer that doesn't proselytize, that doesn't advance, and doesn't in any way disparage, and that is non-sectarian prayer. We can call it what we want, but the tension that is felt here by, and the complaint that the speaker has, is with Marsh and with Allegheny. The Supreme Court is quite clear that the reason that the prayers in Marsh did not violate the line, did not go over an unlawful contemporary prayer practice is because the particular minister there removed references to Jesus. And every appellate case subsequent to Marsh and subsequent to Allegheny has recognized that legislative prayers in the name of Christ, referring to Christ, advance religion. And the prayers here...
How does that do?
I'm sorry?
How does that advance religion, that particular religion, or Christian religion?
It advances religion because it puts the state in the position of praying to, in one particular way. And the prayers in this case...
But
the job
that does
is
imply
to,
it's government speech, though. I
oh,
mean, I think you have to take the position, because if it's private speech, if it's more like Rosenberger, you know, where one person prays in the name of Jesus and somebody else invokes the prophet Muhammad and so on, that reflects the religious diversity of our country.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And if tomorrow the speaker says the Church of the American Knights of the Ku Klux Klan and the demonologists and the Wicca are all welcome to pray, then maybe there would be a different case. But that's not the case. During the trial, the speaker's attorney said, and the speaker has never denied this, that the speaker reserved the right to refuse any prayers that he felt were not consistent with the prayer tradition of the House. That is viewpoint discrimination.
Doesn't he say the Judeo-Christian tradition, actually?
That is correct. It was in response to a question about would you allow a Wicca to pray. Even before this case...
Did he say actually no, he would not allow a Wicca?
He said, now I think that if the speaker were to learn about that sort of prayer and were to understand that it would be something that would not, in his view, the speaker's view, be in keeping with the traditions of the House and excluded, I think there is precedent to exclude a non-Judeo-Christian prayer. That is viewpoint discrimination. Even before this case was filed, the speaker would tell those seeking to pray that they should strive to be ecumenical. That sort of viewpoint discrimination or viewpoint input is completely inconsistent with a limited public forum. Look, I understand why the speaker doesn't want to give up the forum. It makes perfect sense that the speaker, who is the keeper of the Indiana House of Representatives, is not going to let anyone off the street who shows up and says, I want to offer an invocation to pray.
But so your view, if this really were private speech and we're talking limited public forum, the speaker would have to give up a number of measures of control that he is up until now exercised.
He would have to give up all control once the person indicated that they were there to give an invocation. Any measure of control, and of course he has control, he has to have control. None of the cases that have addressed this issue of legislative prayer have accepted it's a limited public forum because in addition to the facts here showing it's not, it would be nonsensical for the speaker to open up the doors of the House and say, everyone come on in, you can now speak to the House of Representatives. That's not how it's done. This is purely government speech, and as government speech, it's regulated by Marsh and Allegheny and the appellate cases we have cited, which all indicate that this sort of prayer is advancing religion. And I should add, the prayers in this case are extraordinary, Your Honor. We're not dealing just with clerics who begin and end in Christ's name we pray.
No, but we're developing a rule that's going to, notwithstanding this particular...
Of course, Your Honor.
And which may implicate even farther than this. I think this stands for a surrogate for Congress, as a matter of fact, because the prayers that are used in Congress would be, may be violent and violative of this type of injunction.
I have no idea what people in Congress are told. I do not know if they're being told they should pray in a non-sectarian way, and a number of clerics are disobeying that. I assume that Congress is not a limited public forum.
How would you enforce the injunction in this case if a minister or a priest or a rabbi or whatever violated the terms of the injunction?
Well, the injunction against the Speaker of the House. This is no different than if there's a graduation prayer case where the court orders the school to have no prayer in the graduation, and they invite someone, and they start praying. Well, they pray. You don't tackle them. You don't remove them.
Or you turn off the sound or something.
Well,
like
I don't even know if you do that, Your Honor. I think that this goes against the Speaker, and I think the beauty of the trial court's injunction, beauty might be too strong a word, is that it so clearly indicates to the person praying what they need to do. Because despite what the Speaker is arguing, we all know what a non-sectarian prayer is. Yes, it might be oxymoronic from a theological perspective, but it's what's demanded by Marsh, and it's demanded by Allegheny. We all understand what that is. Maybe there's some gray area at the border, but I have to tell you, many people have delivered non-sectarian
prayers.
So
is it your view, if the Speaker gives exactly the advice that the district court's injunction sets forth, you know, he copies the language and
yeah.
hands it out in the letters of invitation, and then somebody stands up there one day and starts a long sectarian harangue, is the Speaker in contempt at that point, or does it depend on what the Speaker does when the person
no.
begins the harangue?
No, Your Honor, the Speaker is not in contempt. The Speaker...
Speaker's done everything the injunction asks him to do.
And that's completely the case, and I think the judge has indicated that in his response in the Rule 59. The Speaker's duty is very limited. This is an extremely limited injunction. The Speaker is only to basically improve upon the information he is already giving to people, which people have not been listening to. And knowing that, the trial judge says, look, this is really what we mean. We're not asking you to go to a dictionary. We're not asking you to try and figure this out. We're saying that this prayer must be non-sectarian, and that means... you don't refer to Christ, and for everyone else who would refer to other deities, you don't refer to specific denominational appeals. That
well,
is
the record
the
shows,
duty.
Of course, that the rabbi and the imam gave non-sectarian
of course, Your
invocations.
Honor. And that, and of course, Your Honor. And the trial court noted that those from minority religions probably would be more sensitive than those from majority religions to try and keeping things general and keeping things non-sectarian. That is what is that is what is required by Marsh. That is what is required by Allegheny. The injunction in this case, Your Honors, is not appreciably different than that approved by the Fourth Circuit in Wynn or the California Court of Appeals in Rubin. Both of those said to those praying, in the case of Wynn, you must not refer to specific deities. In the case of Rubin, you must pray in a non-sectarian manner. The Fourth Circuit in the Simpson case cited with approval a policy that not only said you must pray in a non-sectarian manner, but that you must not refer to Christ.
What are we to make, though, of the fact that a number of people, these are representations in the amicus briefs for the most part, have said, if I were to receive advice like that, it would be inconsistent with the dictates of my conscience even to go to the Indiana House of Representatives and offer an invocation?
Your Honor, this is government speech. The fact that someone cannot cabin their own private religious speech to fit what is required in a government forum, I certainly appreciate the fact that they have those, that they have that viewpoint, but they don't have the right to express their own religion in government speech.
You think that's about the same as a doctor saying, I want Medicaid funds, but in my conscience, I have to advise abortions now and then?
Well, yes, Your Honor, although I would say it's even further from that, because we're dealing here with one very small aspect of government speech. And none of us have the right to go into court and start praying the way we want to and go into any government building and start praying the way we want to. This is government speech, and Marsh is clear, as is Allegheny. The long history, which we concede, of course, the long history of legislative prayer in this country cannot justify contemporary prayer that allies the government with particular faith. That's not our opinion. That's the language of the United States Supreme Court. And these prayers did exactly that, Your Honors.
What would be the problem with, let's go back to the Wiccans, and letting, if a Wiccan approaches a speaker and says, I'd like to give a prayer, letting the Wiccan give a prayer, or whatever they give?
Well, there wouldn't be any problem if the speaker was willing to open the forum, as I said, to those who were members of the Church of the American Knights, so they could pray as white supremacists pray, or to people who were demonologists. But the speaker obviously doesn't want to do that. No policy.
Well, I'm talking about in general, not to this speaker, in general, as a policy of saying, whatever religion, you're free to express the views of that religion as long as you're not proselytizing and so forth.
Well, if in fact the speaker is opening up the forum, then we have a different case, Your Honor. The problem here in this case is we're not dealing with a limited public forum. We're dealing with a forum that the speaker tightly controls. The people who pray are submitted by legislators themselves, so there's some sort of...
Well, they only come by invitation, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And they can ask to be invited, but they need the invitation.
That's correct, Your Honor. So there's a filtering role done by the legislators before it even gets to the speaker. There could be a limited public forum, but if the speaker wants to have a limited public forum, he has to go in with his eyes open and recognize that once he opens that forum, he can't say no to anyone who is there to give an invocation. And I would submit, naturally, he doesn't want to do that, and no one would want to do that.
He can't limit it to ministers of religion from the state of Indiana?
Well, no, Your Honor. He'd have to then define what a minister is, and then he'd be involved in the very same theological disputes that he says he can't be involved in.
Most state codes do a pretty good job of that with respect to who can officiate at a marriage.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, but at this point, the speaker is not limiting, and you would have anyone who says they're a practitioner, and even if you do, then you run into people who are members of third-party religions who have some licenses from out of state, and the speaker is trying to decide if they're valid. It would get the speaker into precisely the situation that he says he does not want to be in.
I have difficulty seeing what is wrong with a situation where the Speaker of the House of Representatives adopts a policy that the pastors from all of the various religions in the state of Indiana can, through their elected representative, come and give a prayer. He limits it, yes, pastors in the state of Indiana, of all faits. These are the people who are represented by that body.
Yes, sir.
Is there anything wrong with that?
Well, Your Honor, that's not the policy here, of course. And again, we're saying, could you have a limited public forum where you say you're going to be given prayer and we restrict the speakers to those who are licensed ministers?
But you'd be talking, I'm thinking of the Bureau of Prisons, which might be some rough number. And the Bureau of Prisons recognizes certainly well in excess of 50 different religions. And I guess your point is, first, sticking with the facts of this record, it's not the policy we have, but it might be careful what you wish for. You might get it.
And that's precisely why the speaker has reserved unto himself the right to say, no, I'm not going to allow the person who's from the Church of the American Knights of the Ku Klux Klan who has a license from the Universalist Church of California to come in and give a prayer because I think that's inconsistent. That demonstrates, Your Honor, that we're dealing here with government speech.
Is it different if we have an employed chaplain, a chaplain who's paid by the House? Does that make any difference?
No, Your Honor. The march is quite clear that there's nothing unconstitutional per se about an employed public chaplain, provided that the prayers are not proselytizing or advanced.
Well, like in Congress, where the name of Jesus Christ is used, right?
Well, the prayers would indicate that, Your Honor, but there's never been a challenge to that. And again, I do not know what the policy is.
That's what I say. This injunction would change the way Congress operates.
Well, Your Honor, this injunction is no different than that issued in Wynn, which said to the county council there, look, when you pray, you have to tell the person they cannot refer to specific denominations. It's no different than the policy in the other cases as well.
It's a safer situation, actually, than the one Congress uses. Congress actually employs a minister of a particular denomination. And Congress in the last session had a real row over who should be appointed, and it came down to a question of the particular denomination involved. But here, rather than employ a minister of a particular religion, the speaker is allowing every religion to have an opportunity to lead the prayer or to say the prayer.
The speaker's not allowing every religion, Your Honor, because the speaker has reserved to himself the right to refuse people who are praying. And the mere fact that people have filtered up through their legislators to the speaker, who happen to all invariably be Christian, with two exceptions last term, doesn't show there's an open system here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. How much time does Mr. Johnson have? He has 4 minutes.
Excuse me. me, Your Honor.
Your Honor, the prayers at issue in this case are not meaningfully different from the prayers that have been offered in the halls of Congress from the founding of the Republic down to today. These prayers are collected in our brief from pages 25 to 33.
Is it the Speaker's position, though? I mean, what? I guess I'm troubled by the thought that there may have been a time in our country's history that, you know, of course, cited in some of the briefs, people said we're a Christian nation, or Justice Story thought we were a Christian nation, all of this, and no one worried about appeals to Christ versus the more modern, let's just call it post-World War II era, if you want to, where the religious diversity of the country has become quite rich, especially in the major cities, but everywhere else too. And the context has changed. If you're not Christian and you're being prayed at in the name of Jesus Christ, maybe your religion actually repudiates that notion. That's not a problem?
Your Honor, it's our position that Marsh provides a safe harbor. The counsel for the plaintiffs...
But Marsh said you can't proselytize. You think just saying Jesus Christ doesn't proselytize. I think that must
absolutely
be the
not,
point.
Your Honor. If you look at what the court says, it says that the framers did not regard the sorts of prayers that they heard, quote, as a proselytizing activity or as a form of sectarian favoritism.
I think you're rephrasing, but anyway, we'll look at it.
I'll quote it for
yeah.
you, Your Honor. At page 792, the court says that the prayers that the framers heard, quote, are not to be regarded, quote, as a proselytizing activity or as symbolically placing the government's official seal of approval on one religious view. They uniformly heard Christian prayers. Now, obviously, that is not what's happening in Indiana. They respect the diversity and the religious diversity of this nation.
So you think now a Jewish rabbi wouldn't need to refrain from giving an overtly sectarian Jewish prayer?
No, we don't, Your Honor, just as the Episcopal priest at the founding didn't, and just as in Congress today.
Saying only you are the chosen people and everybody else in the room is not chosen.
Obviously, Your Honor, there might be things that are offensive to some people.
Well,
but
which are part of the religion, right.
It's notable that that the court in Marsh did not find the sorts of prayers that the framers heard as proselytizing. The district court really didn't even find that these are proselytizing prayers. He focused on the sectarian, non-sectarian distinction. And the court in Marsh also emphasized the importance of context. This is a legislature. These are grown-ups. In other contexts where the court is particularly concerned about impressionable youth, there might be different rules. That's part of the lesson of Weissman. But in this context, we're dealing with people who have their beliefs and are unable to understand fully that when someone stands within their own tradition and says, you know, I'm praying in the name of such and such God, that that's their belief and not necessarily the belief of others.
Which is why I get back to my other question, kind of is, maybe that's the message that needs to be reinforced, not other things.
Well,
that,
Your Honor,
the person, instead of saying, this is something for all of us, we're all appealing in this name, maybe the person needs to make it very clear. It seems to me that that's the kind of thing that lies behind some of the Supreme Court's limited public forum cases, like Rosenberger and Southworth, where the court has bent over backwards to make sure that each person has, or each group in that instance, has its own voice.
Your Honor, in Rosenberger, there was a disclaimer that the university said, we don't sponsor the views of the student information groups
right.
that we fund.
Right, and there's no disclaimer here, of course.
No, there's not, and Marsh does not suggest that one is required. I would emphasize in response to the questioning about the forum issue, the record is clear, both from the stay affidavits and from the affidavit of the speaker below, that no minister has ever been turned down.
But the record doesn't include, at least as far as I was able to tell, affidavits from all 100 members of the legislature. We don't know whether they have ever declined to issue an invitation.
Actually, the affidavit says he's not aware of any
instance.
He
isn't aware of it, but there are 100 people. I mean,
that would
so
be the plaintiff's burden to establish,
have...
Your Honor. It wouldn't be our burden to disestablish
right, but
it.
But I'm just saying, I guess the record isn't quite as clear. I certainly take the speaker at his word that he doesn't know about it, but it could have happened.
I would direct the court specifically to the stay affidavits and Speaker Bosman's affidavit below. In closing, if I might just say, we live in a pluralistic society in which there's tremendous religious diversity. Indiana has chosen to respect that diversity and to treat everyone as equal in the eyes of the law, regardless of their faith, by allowing everyone to pray in accordance with conscience. We urge the court to vacate the injunction in this case.
Mr. Johnson. The court would like to thank both Mr. Johnson and Mr. Falk, and also the amicus curiae, Mr. Sturgill, for their fine presentations today and the very professional manner in which this matter has been discussed. It's obviously a difficult case, can raise great emotion, but we compliment the attorneys for their professionalism. The case will be taken under advisement.